Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at Carriage Works at the 2018 Festival.
It's always a good thing when back of stage you're told, no, you're supposed to be sitting down on the stage now while the thing is playing. We got that wrong, but we're here. Please, big round of applause for these two extraordinary authors. Welcome to Carriage Works. Welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival session. My name's Michael Williams. I'm the director of the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne, and I'm very excited to be here with these two authors whose work I absolutely revere. It's a session about historical fiction, so I'm going to kick off with Napoleon, because where better to start? Napoleon said that history is a set of lies agreed upon, which is also a good way to describe a writer's festival, I think it would be. In this country, we know that the set of lies that we agree upon are the idea of country. This is Gadigal land, the Eora Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and the members of other communities who might be here today. It's a lie agreed upon because it's a lie around sovereignty. It's a lie around the idea that old ideas and old hurts are resolved. And so we acknowledge country to pause for a moment and think about the ways in which those stories aren't true and the stories that we need to make sure that we tell and remember. Min Jin Lee's Pachinko was a finalist for the 2017 National Book Award. It was, and I like this fact in the bio, listed on more than six dozen best books of the year lists around the world. Six dozen, think about that. It included the top 10 books of the year for the New York Times, USA Today, San Francisco Chronicle, the BBC, the New York Public Library, my own list of best books of the year. I mean, they're all pretty much equal, I think, for prestige, you'll agree. Min's debut novel, Free Food for Millionaires, was also in the top 10 books of the year for The Times, NPR's Fresh Air, and USA Today. Please make her very welcome. And Jennifer Egan is the author of several novels and a short story collection. Her 2010 novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and it was my book of the year. Again, prestige, it's all relative. Also a journalist, she's written frequently in the New York Times magazine. Her new novel, Manhattan Beach, became an instant New York Times bestseller. It's been awarded the American Library Association's Andrew Carnegie Medal for excellence in fiction. And in March 2018, she was named the new president of PEN America. Please make her very welcome. And I'm gonna start with Pachinko because your opening words a challenge to this very session. The novel kicks off with the words, history has failed us, but no matter. How has history failed us?
I think history has failed us all the time. It continues to fail us. And I majored in history in college because I didn't know what to do. And one of the things that I really learned is that in order to be a historian, you have to work with primary documents, right? Which means that most people in the world who are illiterate cannot leave primary documents. So I was really struck by the fact that we don't know hardly anything about most people, especially working class people, especially poor people, people of color, almost all colonized people. So I thought about that a great deal, and the more I thought about it, the more history has failed us, then maybe things shouldn't continue the way it does. However, what I learned from all my interviews, because I do a lot of interviews in my historical research, is that people don't really seem to care about the fact that history fails them. Every single person pretty much adapts and takes care of his or her family accordingly. And I think for me, after I did all those interviews, I started to realize that it's really about the resistance and the defiance that really characterizes people who've been left out of history.
You say you studied history because you didn't know what else to do, but for those who were able to catch your wonderful speech the other night for the opening night of the festival, you mentioned then that it was in part because you felt a certain imposter syndrome about being a writer, that you had to choose other paths rather than writing, rather than telling your own story. Was there always a link for you between the telling of stories and the stories of others in the history?
Oh, I think my own story is not terribly interesting. But I do like the stories of other people. So in both of my works, in all of my two novels, massive of... Anyway, I do them by interviewing people. And because most people are much more interesting than my life, so I like to do that.
Don't you think everyone thinks other people are more interesting than they are?
No.
Oh.
No.
I'm so sorry, I forgot.
I've done a lot of interviews, Michael, you know that's not true.
I forgot you're American. That's never the case. Your nation is built on that. I'm sorry, I won't take cheap shots. Jennifer, you famously said that time is a goon. And yet in your new book, you give over to ideas of time that are far more linear and conventional than in your previous novel. How much of that was a leap for you, or how much of that is an extension of that same idea about the permeability of time?
I wasn't really thinking about time when I was working on this book, actually. I started, as I do with all of my books, with a time and a place. And I was very interested in New York during World War II. That's kind of all I knew. I think that arose pretty directly from 9/11, because New York felt like a war zone overnight. And I think as Americans, we have basically no collective memory anymore of that. And so it was kind of shocking, honestly. And it led me to wonder what the city felt like during the war. And so that was basically all I started with. And then I sort of meandered in various directions in response to that. Most immediately, just looking at images of the city, I was reminded of the fact that the water was an incredibly important conduit for people, goods, you know, that it was sort of an active part of commercial and traveling life until basically the post-war era. And so in a certain sense, I sort of followed the water into various worlds of the novel. In terms of the structure, I had originally thought I would do a lot more kind of innovative things with it. I had all kinds of ideas. I thought, well, I like to play with time, so I've been told. So surely I'm going to do that here. I'm not going to just write a novel set in the past. That seems so kind of obvious. And I felt like I needed to account for the fact that we're all reading it in the present by kind of winking at the reader or acknowledging that I know that it's not actually 1942. But what I found was that all of that was disastrous when I tried to do it in this context. It felt very flat, it felt manipulative, and it actually felt much more obvious than just setting a story in another time. In other words, we all realize it's not 1942. I don't really need to remind the reader of that. And so what I found was that actually the present exists almost allegorically. The present and everything between 1942 and the present floats as a sort of another level of meaning that we all understand, and there's absolutely no reason to call attention to it. I only diminished the strength of the storytelling when I did that. So I'm a pragmatist. I do what I think is working, and I definitely jettison whatever is not.
I'm curious, I just want to pick you up on, you mentioned there, you said, I like to play with time, or so I've been told. Do you resist that reading of your work?
No, not at all. I mean, A Visit from the Goon Squad is explicitly about time. I mean, that was my subject. But I think I mean more that there's always this danger of starting to believe that you're supposed to be the person everyone says you are or the writer that everyone says you are. And I thought, well, you know, A Visit from the Goon Squad is really the book that granted me a larger audience than I had ever had. And so I thought, oh, well, people are going to expect me to do structural crazy things and somehow acknowledge the element of time in historical novel. But the truth is, none of that really made sense in this book. That was just ideas I had about what people might expect. And in the end, those ideas never lead to good fiction.
I'm interested because you said that it was disastrous trying that. And I read an interview with you where you talked about that early draft in the most scathing terms, like just absolutely brutal. And you said it had caricaturish people, horrible dialogue, stupid and obvious moves, blundering historical context. And so when you put that all together, you end up with something that's truly nauseating. And I kind of mean that literally. I felt physical illness reading my own book.
Can you tell I was raised a Catholic?
Sounds like you have a good time with it, though.
I mean, I think there's a certain amount of exaggeration in there. But the truth is, my first drafts are always pretty bad. And I think in this case, it was worse because since I don't write it, we have this in common. I don't like to write about myself at all. I find it very boring. I'm looking to escape into the writing process just as I look to escape when I read. So, but the one thing I really do use for my own life is times and places that I know. So just kind of scenes, atmospheres, milieus that I remember. Well, I had none of that in this book. So what I found was that I felt that it was very thin texturally. It just felt for a long time like there was no... I felt like I couldn't move around and do my thing as a writer, and therefore it had a very stiff quality, like someone at a party who just can't loosen up, so they basically end up seeming kind of dull because we don't know what's going on inside them. That's kind of how the book read for a while, and that was really difficult. I wasn't sure I could actually get past that. But one thing that's interesting is that the period I'm writing about still exists in living memory. So I also conducted a lot of interviews, but with people who actually, you know, lived at the, you know, women, for example, who worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard during the Second World War. And so in that way, one thing that was sort of nice about the research was that I felt like I was actually helping or sometimes just witnessing the creating of a permanent record of voices that might not otherwise be heard. And I was really struck by that when you talked about, you know, people whose stories don't end up being available later to people looking back. It was really wonderful to feel like with some of these people, especially some of the women who were in their 80s when we were interviewing them, and that was the first decade of the 21st century, you know, that we were really getting these stories down and transcribing them in ways that will make them available later. I'm really happy about that.
So to what extent, once you're with interviewing real people about their memories, you're playing with live ammunition, how much does that change the book you're writing? How much do you find yourself hearing human stories that push your story off its track? Because Pachinko started life as a book called Motherland.
That's right.
You've similarly described in fairly unflattering terms in its earlier
It was also
version.
Nauseating, yes.
Nauseating, oh, that's good. That's good what word. We're going for today, is as much nausea as we can get. But for you, did that process of talking to people change the book? Is
it
that where the shape came from?
It changed me, it changed the book. It made me realize that I was so wrong about everything. It was absolutely humbling because I did so much academic research, and I felt like, you know, I have these sort of good homework bona fides. And I was like, I'm going to read every single book about the Korean Japanese. I'm going to know everything. And I think I was historically accurate. Like, my data was correct. However, I didn't understand how people respond to desperate situations. And most people, interestingly, when you have a desperate situation, your best self actually comes out, which I didn't really think about. And that was really good, but it was very depressing because I had to throw a whole book away.
I had to throw it away entirely? It's not
I kept exactly
skeleton?
One chapter.
Which chapter?
The one on fingerprinting.
Ah, right.
What was wrong? What I'm curious about how these conversations made what you had already written feel not right.
Oh, that's a really good question. The first book was very self-righteous. Like, I was really pro-victim and thinking that I was going to go in there and save people. And then, of course, when I met the people, they're like, you're not the one. You are not going to save me. Maybe we'll save you because you're kind of pathetic. I mean, they were very clear because I would start crying, literally crying at some of these stories they would tell me. And they're going, why are you so upset about this?
Wow.
It's just the way things are. They were so tough. And then I realized, oh, why don't I have the toughness in this book? Why don't I have their resilience in this book? And I think it's because I thought I was a smart one, but I was not.
There are two really powerful kind of engines to the book. One is family and the other is the experience of immigration. And it seems to me that the way those stories are told embodies kind of the best of history.
I hope so.
The migrant story has to be one of remembering so that it can be passed on between generations. How much How much was that your intention, that the story here was explicitly about a Korean family making it in Japan, or how much of that is just backdrop?
Oh, well, before I answer that question, I forgot to do something really important. I just want to thank Michael for doing this work. I've done this job. You've done this job, right?
It's I just so can't hard. Wait to read your book. It sounds
no,
amazing.
But being a moderator is really difficult, and he's doing it really well, and I want to thank you, Michael, for your time.
You've gone too soon with that. We're 15 minutes in. That is brutal. Hold your applause.
And then secondly, I'm a total fangirl of Jennifer Egan, so I got so happy when I knew that I could work, you know, be here today, so thank you for letting me be here. So did I?
You haven't gone too soon on that. That's quite acceptable. Has that?
So I feel really lucky, so thank you.
I'm glad to hear it. That question about immigration, though, and the immigrant experience, and how important it is for new generations, part of what is so powerful in your book is it has the effect of a kind of telescoping focus, that every time, as a reader, you feel you have a handle on who your central character is, you move generations, you move sideways, you move along, and you get the sense of the ways in which different generations' experience of being a migrant almost work against each other. There's not one story in a family. Did that come out of the oral histories, or did you have the kind of family in your mind first?
It came out of the oral histories. So what ended up happening is Motherland was supposed to be about Solomon, who's about 3% of the book now. And Solomon, for those of you who have not read the book, is a Wall Street kid. And he's educated in the US, and he's Korean-Japanese. So I had written an entire manuscript called Motherland about Solomon and his dad, who's a rich pachinko parlor owner. And then in 2007, when I moved to Japan, I started to interview these Solomon types of people. And after I interviewed half a dozen of them, I realized, oh my God, you are so dull. Like, you cannot carry a novel. And the only thing that was interesting about them was the fact that they were talking about their progenitors and the first generation, the kind of sacrifices they made. And then I realized, oh, the reason why they're not interesting is not because they're not interesting. It's because they had so much anxiety about being perfect, and which I thought was really fascinating about what happens as you go up in class. You start to have more and more kind of, I guess, barriers between you and a regular person because you're less desperate. Because when you're desperate, you express your need, right? And when you're poor and when you're without friends, without resources, you are going to be vulnerable. And the people that I met were almost invulnerable to me, almost unavailable to me. And I realized it's not because you're not interesting, it's because you have this incredible formality, because you've been taught all these things. Because by the time you become a rich person and a powerful person, a really well-educated person, you realize that you don't have to show yourself to everybody. You can choose. And so I realized, oh, I have to write a historical novel. How dreadful. Because it's so hard.
Yes.
Right? It's so
hard. I totally
hard.
Understand that.
This is a therapy session. Clearly.
It is. We're nauseous. We've had a hard time.
You didn't just describe that as hard, though. When you said historical novel, you said it almost with a look of disdain on your face.
I think the word was dreadful. I was full of dread because I thought I had done all the homework, and I had, in a way of like looking at academic work. But then I realized, oh, I don't have to interview just, you know, 50 people, because I easily interview 50 people per book. Even stories, I interview people all the time. I realized I had to do field work, I had to go to the locations, I had to do so much more work, and I had to go to the archival research, which I wasn't really that interested in doing.
Why did you have to? Why couldn't you just make it up?
Because I'm neurotic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also realistic fiction, you know, the conceit of it is that it has to have realistic details, because you will have readers going with you if they believe you. And in order for people to believe you, you have to be accurate. So that was important to me.
Jennifer, was there any point for you in your research where the facts got in the way of the good story?
I mean, there were two phases of research. One, I was writing other books when I was doing some of the research for this book. So, for example, when I was first looking at those images and thinking about New York during the war for the first time, that was like 2004, 2005. So I was working on two books ago. And I'm very glad about that timing, because actually a lot of the people that we interviewed were in their 80s around then. So there was not a decade to wait. So during that, between 2005 and 2010, I did sort of, I would say, kind of desultory experiential research, which was really fun. I worked on the Oral History Project. I went to a reunion of Army divers because I'd got, following the waterfront, the first stop was the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was like 7 blocks from where I was living and was the largest builder and repairer of Allied ships in the world during the war. Who knew? I had never been there. There was a lot of the war still left at the Navy Yard, which was decommissioned in the 60s and has been an industrial park ever since, and becomes more kind of modern and remarkable by the minute. But in 2005, when I first visited it, you know, there were buildings that had old World War II maps on the walls still. And then I learned that in my research of the Navy Yard that diving was an important part of ship repair. I had no idea. I've never even scuba dived. So I got very interested in that kind of diving. And I fell in with a group of veteran Army divers, and they have a reunion every other year. And so I went to the reunion, and one of the things that they offer at their reunions to the attendees is the chance to wear the old equipment, which is the Mark V diving apparatus, which anyone would, I think, conjure. In fact, one reason we all can picture it is that it was current really until the 60s. So this pretty much the same equipment was worn through the entire 20th century until the 60s with the big spherical helmet. So anyway, they dressed me in it. Needless to say, I did not dive. But it was interesting to wear just to be dressed in it. It weighs 200 pounds, so it was not comfortable. But I guess to address the same question you posed a minute ago, like how does the research impact the plot? There was no story at all at that point. But I just thought, well, I think I'm going to have people diving, so I should know what this thing feels like. The takeaway from that experience for me was not that it hurt a lot to wear a 200-pound suit. I don't think I needed to actually do that to write about it. But what was fascinating and the thing that made the experience so memorable was the feeling of being dressed in the suit. So these were these two Vietnam veterans who had been very helpful and generous with me and talked a lot about diving, and they had worn the old equipment. And now it was time for me to wear the suit, so they were dressing me. I was standing there in long underwear, and then they started putting it on. And at first I felt a little weird, because suddenly these two gentlemen that I'd had a rather professional relationship with were essentially handling me and kind of touching me. And I thought, oh dear, this is so awkward. And then I realized that they didn't find it awkward at all, because they were serving as my tenders, and this was stuff, they were both master divers, they had done this for years and years. And once I relaxed into it, I felt actually very comforted. And in a way, I mean, the job of the tenders is to keep the diver alive, and all divers are also tenders. And so that kind of intimacy went from feeling awkward to feeling domestic and very comforting. And that sensation and my memory of it actually ended up becoming very important in the plot. So that was the way in which the research that happened long before there was any story created certain kinds of awareness in me and details and textures that when I started writing, which I do very blindly and impulsively for my first drafts, some of that came to bear on the story in ways that I wouldn't have expected.
I don't think I've heard many sentences I like more than the one that begins, "I fell in with a group of retired Navy divers." We've all been there. So does that mean it was inevitable? Because part of what's so wonderful about Manhattan Beach is it's a powerfully feminist book, and Anna's experience as a woman in that era is a crucial part of what you're writing about. I'm interested in where that came in and how that fits with what you said about the present as an overlay on writing about the past.
Well, I think one thing is my work tends to really skew toward the male, and part of that is the fact that I love the feeling of being far away from my own life, and there's no faster way to divide what I'm doing from my own life than to write from the point of view of a man, and I find myself doing it quite a lot. So The Keep is very male. That's 2 books ago. A Visit from the Goon Squad, I struggled to keep it 50-50. And barely managed it. So I had started to think as I was working on Goon Squad, you know, I'm really starting to turn into a writer who seems to really favor writing about men, and I don't like that. I don't want it. I am a feminist. I think a lot about what it means to be a woman, how feminine strength struggles to be recognized and to really thrive, at least in contemporary American culture. And so I had sort of had on my bucket list the idea I want to write a book that in some way is not only more feminine, but really about being female. And so as I was thinking about time and place, New York during World War II, it seemed like that would be a really good time to explore female life and some female strength, I should say. I still have two male protagonists to my one female, so I can't say. I think if you measured the amount of pages I spend with men versus women, I might still have skewed toward the male. But Anna really is the heart of the book. But the thing that's a little strange is, as I was writing it, I thought, what's really great about setting this so long ago is that life was so tremendously different. I mean, the rules governing female behavior were very different. And of course, during the war, a lot of those rules were suspended temporarily. So it was a very interesting moment to look at. But I was also thinking, but you know, things have changed so dramatically between men and women. For example, women weren't allowed to go on ships for the first 2 years that they worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard because there was a feeling that the men might not be able to control themselves. You know, who would know knew what would happen in these small spaces? And the women hated it, of course. They were doing work that related to ships but not allowed to go on ships. It was ridiculous. But ultimately, they were really needed on the ships because they tended to be slighter, they were more limber, they were actually very well made to get into these small spaces. So they ended up on ships. But you know, shortly after the book came out, I found myself thinking, you know, we've been living in a time where there are no protections anymore to try to make safe work environments for women. And yet we're closer to a time when at least some men have had a very hard time controlling themselves in the workplace than I ever would have imagined. So it really was, I felt like it seemed much closer to the era I was writing about than I really would have thought.
Mm. We don't have that problem in Australia.
Oh, good. That's I'm relieved to hear that.
We're very evolved. Yeah. What kind of responsibility do you feel when you're writing about the past, especially having talked to so many people about their own experience? Is it that both your books are historical novels, so there may be no point of comparison for you, but do you feel a kind of burden, a weight of truth that you had to somehow honour in the way you told the stories?
I feel an enormous burden of representation for many different groups, and it's exhausting. And I used to think, is it grandiose to even think that you have a burden of representation? But then because like people keep asking me questions about North Korea, I'm like, oh no, I guess I do have it. I better study up. But I also feel a burden of representation, not just for my group, but also just my socioeconomic class, for being immigrants, for like Presbyterians. I mean, there's a lot of things that I've been outed at this point of all these different aspects of my life, and I don't want to mess it up because I'm one of the first to get to certain places. So I do feel the sense of burden, and I want to get it accurate. But I don't know what else to do besides, like, I think I would be lying to you if I said I don't feel it. Mm. I feel it a lot.
Are you not tempted to write? I mean, in terms of what you're working on next, are you ever tempted to free yourself of that? I think James Wood said, and not a fan of historical fiction, but he famously referred to historical fiction as backward-looking science fiction, that it was you were still creating imagined worlds, you were just doing it cast back in the past. Do you reject that idea of historical fiction?
You know, I had dinner with James last week.
Excellent answer.
And he didn't mention it. In James's defense. No, I'm just teasing. No, I did actually have dinner with him. I was giving a talk at Harvard, and he was there, and he was lovely. And he's got a book coming out, actually, this year. Yeah.
Well, you can say something rude about his genre and return the favor.
I wouldn't dare. I'm working on a trilogy. So the first book is Free Food for Millionaires, and that is set in 1980s New York. It's about the Koreans in America. My second book, Pachinko, is about the Koreans in Japan. My third book is going to be called American Hagwon. A Hagwon is a tutoring center. So it's about the role of education for Koreans. My trilogy is a diaspora trilogy. It's about the Koreans. And I do feel the sense of I want to be accurate. However, I also think it's very important to be interesting. I meet readers all over the world who feel very burned by books. They'll spend $27 on a book, and they'll get 30% in, and it's not very good. And they stop reading, and now they have this thing called Netflix. Have you heard of it?
It hasn't come up.
Yeah, so that's what we're competing against. And I do think it's important to have a sense of a book being edifying. That's very important. But it also should be entertaining. And I think that intersection is difficult to do. I think if you do write historical fiction, and my second book is primarily much more historical fiction than my first, I want people to enjoy the study of history. Because to me, without knowing it, you'll always have an incorrect perspective. Like, for example, since we've been here, what, 30 minutes now?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, so I guess I can talk about Donald Trump now. So.
A klaxon will sound. It's a no-Trump zone.
Because, you know, after he won, I remember everybody thinking that the whole world had ended. And I thought, if you study history, the world has not ended. This is not the worst moment in American history. There have been far worse moments in American history than the election of Donald Trump. I am not a fan of Mr. Trump. However, I don't think it's the end of civilization. I just don't. I mean, civilization didn't end with Andrew Jackson. We kept on going. And again, like, I guess my point is that we are defiant. History keeps failing, but I think all of us keep responding saying, there's a person in charge who we don't agree with, however, we're going to carry on. And I like that very much.
Do you agree with that, Jennifer?
Yeah, so many things that you said resonate with me. I mean, back to when you say history's failed us, I guess what I immediately thought is, isn't it that we've failed history? I mean, I feel like there's such a... But I think it really comes from the fact that it's so hard for us to really and truly see beyond the span of our own lives. I mean, it's just very difficult to I think, conceptually really believe that all those things happened. And it's interesting because I find now, I'm now 55, and that's more than half a century. It's had a huge effect on my ability to see history differently. I realized that really, you know, let's say Shakespeare's time was not actually that long ago.
No.
I mean, it was a few of my lifetimes strung together. But that's something that I've only just begun to understand. So I think there's sort of a conceptual problem. It's a little like looking at the stars and actually believing that there are real things out there. But I think if we can read history in the way of really believing it, it changes very much what we see in the present. Absolutely.
Also, do you feel like as a reader, before you're a writer, we're constantly having to imagine different things, right?
Yes, but imagine is the key.
Right.
Because I think we tend to think of it as an imaginary landscape and not things that really happened. I think I fall prey to that very much.
I was thinking about Napoleon, because you brought him up earlier. Like, we know that Napoleon existed because there are witnesses and there are documents related to Napoleon. But if we didn't look at that evidence, we still have to think, oh, did Napoleon really exist? Right? And I think what I like about all this is that you can sort of imagine what Napoleon was like based on his documents or because based on our imagination. And part of, I think, as a writer, your job is to create such a vivid world that the reader can participate in it and be a character in history. And that's really kind of sexy.
Is that partly an act of translation, like bringing to life the past, but at the same time making it accessible through a contemporary lens? Like,
I mean, I think for me, and again, I really work so instinctively that any thought tends to happen kind of in between instinctively driven drafts, and there is a lot of thought. I mean, I make a very analytical outline, and I have a huge list of things I need to do, but then I sort of go back into the writing mindset, and I'm not thinking about all that. The way it tended to work for me was that I had to know what I was talking about very clearly, especially in the technical worlds that I was dealing with, which were deep sea diving, shipbuilding, the merchant marine, and sort of waterfront crime and mob activity, none of which I knew a thing about before I started the book. But once I knew about that stuff, then, and really knew it, then I could start playing around and taking chances. And in a way, all of the big moves of the book are kind of pushing it in terms of what's possible. They're definitely possible. I mean, the fact that I have a woman diving is probably the most obvious example. Women didn't dive in the Navy until the 70s, and they didn't dive in the Army until the 80s. So I've got a woman diving in 1942. Is that likely? Well, first of all, she's a civilian diver. I would never, ever have made her a military diver, because anyone who knows anything would say that's ridiculous. But the civilian diving was not very carefully recorded. We don't really know what happened at the Brooklyn Navy Yard in terms of who dived. I did interview one World War II diver at that same reunion, and he had dived in the harbor of Cherbourg after the Germans fled, having blown up lots of crap so that no one could use the harbor. So the salvage divers were exploding all of this detritus and removing it, and this gentleman, Jim Kennedy, was doing that. And I asked him if he had encountered any female divers ever, and he had met a female Russian diver diving in Cherbourg, because the Russian women did everything. But another thing, I don't know if this exactly relates to your point, but one thing I really found was that if I knew my stuff really well and then started to imagine, I was oddly right a lot of the time, mm-hmm. when I would check later about whether what I was imagining made sense. And Jane Smiley used this phrase that I love, which is the energy of logic. There's a certain way in which things do follow a kind of progression of possibility. And if you really know what you're talking, if you understand the context, you can follow a progression that may well mirror what would have been possible then. And so just to give you one more example, so there's a kind of culminating scene that I felt myself working toward, which is an illegal dive in New York Harbor, in which a bunch of people who have a lot to lose for various reasons dive down to look for a dead body. So this is a very dangerous thing to do. The harbor was controlled by the military. So from the diver's point of view, it's a very odd thing to do. And I wanted two of these people diving to be able to actually talk to each other while under the water, each in their own 200-pound suit with spherical metal helmet and no radio communication yet at that time. So this is a lot to ask. But so when I got one of my Vietnam vets on the phone, and I sort of with great trepidation said, okay, so this is what I'm envisioning. If they get caught, it's a real catastrophe. You know, someone asks you, will you go dive for a dead body in a military controlled harbor during a war? In these very difficult circumstances, would you ever say yes? And I'm thinking, like, I don't even want to hear the answer. And he said, hell yeah. And I realized, wait a minute, I'm forgetting something. These are people who like risk. And in fact, both of them were so excited by the idea that I couldn't get them. They wouldn't let go. They kept emailing me with more thoughts about the illegal dive and the body and what they might try and what about that. So that was one thing where I thought, oh God, I was so worried about this, but it was a non-issue. They if they could have done it themselves right then, they would have done it. And then the second thing was the thing about talking underwater, where I just thought, okay, this is, I know there's no way this could happen, but I'm just gonna ask, is there any way the two divers could talk underwater? And they said, oh, of course not. I mean, you can't even do that now. I mean, you can talk with topside, but no, I mean, obviously, if they touch their helmets together, they can hear each other, but, you know, they don't have any radios. And I went, what did you just say? And again, It was completely possible they could have a conversation under the water. I couldn't believe it. So that's the kind of thing that feels very lucky. But I think I would be curious to know if you experience that as well, that there's some way in which if you know enough, you can make decisions that actually turn out to be reasonable.
Well, I was terrified of writing this book because I'm Korean American and I was writing about the Korean Japanese. And because the Korean Japanese had been treated so poorly for the past 100 years and even now, I figured for sure that I should not attempt to do this book. So then all of my anxieties made me do all this homework, and then I started to read a lot of war diaries. The war diaries were incredibly helpful. So you had all these personal interviews and memories, but then you had the war diaries, which would kind of affirm everything that they said. And then after I wrote the thing, I have been touring now for about 1.5 years. And now at this point, at every event, I will meet people who are Korean Japanese who have read the book. And they usually come to me and they're holding the book. And they come to the line. And they go, I heard about you. I heard that you're Korean American. And my friend told me that this book is about the Korean Japanese. And they're really sober. And of course, I'm dying because I'm thinking they're going to find a mistake. Right? That's like the worst thing for a Korean, for someone else to find a mistake. The worst. And of course, they'll say, but you got the story of my family. And at every single chapter, they'll bring up some aspect that had happened to their family. So again, I don't know how this happened. And they'll usually start crying, and I'll start crying, and it'll become this enormous sob fest. But I don't know how I intuited these family dynamics with the historical facts, but I think it's the confidence that arises from having done the research, because I do feel enormously confident at this point of the research. I wasn't confident about my entitlement to write this book. Even now, I still feel really anxious about, you know, can that be done? Should it be done? But I really wanted to do it. And this is the first book written in English about the Korean Japanese as a novel in the world. And I knew that that's what it was, but I figured for sure nobody would want that book.
What I'm curious to know what the burden of representation, mm-hmm. what is that? That's not something I have experienced. I feel kind of lucky in that way. Even though in this book I was exploring my own ethnicity, such as it is, as an Irish American, but that, you know, most of the Irish came to America so long ago that there's, you know, for the most part, we're just completely assimilated and you don't even think about it. But so how does that affect the writing process and what does it feel like?
Well, I think self-consciousness is probably the enemy of art, right? But if you look at the Anglophone world, there is an enormously rich body of Irish literature. So even if you weren't writing as an Irish American, you know that Irish literature exists.
So oh, yeah. No, right. But I mean for you.
No, exactly. Exactly. So I think that in a way, when you are an Anglophone person, and if you are white, and you come from a Western tradition, you feel like your experience is universal and individual. The problem with a person like me, because I'm one of the first people, people think that I am representing everybody else. So if there were 100 Korean Americans writing books about Korean Japanese novels, then I can just say, I can make a mistake and it'll just be me. But because I knew I was the first one, I felt like if I get this wrong, I'll have screwed over an entire people. Right?
That's tough.
Still, that's a good day's work. An entire people is hard to do in one go. I can't help but notice that we're touching helmets and proving we can talk underwater up here, and you may have some questions for these two extraordinary writers. There are 4 microphones in the space. The house lights are coming up. If you can make your way to one of those microphones.
This is unreal.
I would ask that I'm from a strange tradition where I believe a question is a thing with a question mark on the end rather than your own extraordinary historical life story. I'm funny like that. I'm sure you're very interesting, but there are some very interesting people here. So the microphones are just there. Until you make your way there, I'm going to keep going, though. And I'm interested. I mean, the thing that really fundamentally strikes me is both your books made me weep. Like, they are beautiful emotional experiences, they're human experiences. And yet to hear you talk, the kind of mechanics behind it, the research of it, the kind of putting together of the puzzle, did you ever fear that would come at the expense of the human stories you wanted to tell?
I mean, if that, in the end, none of it matters except the human stories. I feel that so profoundly. And when I'm actually writing, that's kind of all I'm following. You know, I start without characters or a plot, but just with a time and a place, and I kind of follow my own interest and curiosity and excitement into what, of course, is a kind of big mess, because writing that way just doesn't lead to anything polished or even consistent. Like, characters' names change. I can't remember what I wrote. You know, I wrote a first draft for a year and a half, 1,400 handwritten pages. But I lose a lot of time working that way. And obviously, there are some painful moments I described a little too floridly about what it feels like to read a first draft written that way. The reason I do it is specifically because I'm trying to follow an emotional current that feels alive. That's all I care about. And I couldn't agree more with what you said about, you know, excitement and entertainment. I mean, that's what this is. I feel like if all I feel about a book is that I admired it, that was a failure. I mean, I want people to miss their subway stops, stay up too late, ignore important duties because they're lost. Now, it's a lot to hope for, and I'm sure 99% of my readers would say, yeah, but sorry, that's not how it was for me. But, you know, that's what I'm looking for as a reader, is just to be wrenched out of my life, to really be living two lives at once. That's what I hope for.
I do love that Jennifer Egan writes in longhand, including a Twitter story was written in longhand first, rather than the digital and the analog seem to be bumping up against each other.
It didn't work for PowerPoint, though, I will say. Drawing rectangles, I got nowhere.
I can see that would be limiting. There is a question here on microphone number two.
Hello. It's for both of you, really. But I'm just concerned about writing about place and how you go about creating a place that's authentic, not just a description, but the atmosphere. Do you immerse yourself in, images or music, or how do you create that sense of the past?
Do you want to go first?
Sure. I think that for me, the images are really important. However, when I hear stories, what I'm always looking, so I do all these interviews, and when I'm looking at interviews, I spend a lot of time with my subjects, and usually I focus on little details, but what I've noticed is that people's mannerisms also change with time. So when I talk to a person who's older, younger, middle-aged, they'll have different kinds of mannerisms and kinds of expressions, and that really helps me understand how to write the dialogue of a certain period. My problem was that I was working with three different languages. And then, but in the end, it all had to be in English almost entirely. So I had to convert the mannerism, the physicality, and the dialect all into English. So that took quite a bit of time. But in terms of fixing a place, it's not just visual. A lot of it also has to be emotional. So even if I could talk about, let's say, Osaka or Tokyo, and I'll go to those places and I'll talk to different people and they'll have such different experiences of it because they're humongous cities. And also many of my characters grew up in ghettos, and those ghettos don't exist anymore. And what people would talk about those ghettos were different than what I had read about them. A lot of people are much happier in situations that you and I think that we wouldn't be happy in, if they have people they love around them. That took me by surprise, because I didn't think that you could live in a one-room, basically a hut almost, built out of corrugated metal. That's where they lived, corrugated metal, and wood and paper. That's how they had these little rooms. And six or seven people in a room, people sleeping in shifts, usually having pigs in their homes. And I would say, what was that like? And they'll have these very jolly stories about finding a potato and roasting it. You're going, you just can't believe, but they have these very happy memories. So in a way, you don't want to be overly romantic about it, but you can't, in the same way, assume that people will be miserable living in that way because they don't have clean toilets.
That kind of accommodation in Sydney costs a lot of money. And they talk about it endlessly. It's amazing. But part of what makes your writing so evocative is that it's intensely sensory. Like you use the example of a potato there, but food and cooking and the smells and things, it seems to me they're what I remember when it comes to descriptions of place in pachinko, are those things that create home, I think. It's very
Thank
powerful.
Thank you. Well, it's interesting, you know, usually that's the stuff I know already, you know, writing in my own lifetime, and it does require a lot of different sensory elements. Smell is really important, sound, just all these things that we don't know we know about things we remember. So I felt very empty-handed approaching this material that happened when I wasn't alive. I knew that in terms of New York, I wanted it to be a thriller. I had a sense that it kind of I wanted it to feel like that. And I was pretty sure I wanted to write about New York during the war through a kind of noirish lens. But in a way, I had a sense of the atmosphere I wanted, but I still needed all of the actual details to work with. So it was sort of a mix. It's interesting, like writing about the Brooklyn Navy Yard, even hoping for a kind of noirish lens gave me nothing until I knew a lot about it. But one thing that was really helpful with oral histories and also letters, there was a collection of letters I relied on very, very heavily in my research between a man and a woman who met there and married, and then he joined the Navy and she wrote to him a couple of times a day. And since they had both worked there, she shared all kinds of details about work that she might not have otherwise. But with her letters and then all these oral histories, certain sensory details came up again and again, like the smell of chocolate. Many people mentioned that. And then I was looking at a collection of photographs from the National Archives that you would think would be very dull because they were basically engineering photographs of the Navy Yard. So it was like pictures of people plumbing. But in the background of those pictures, there was all kinds of other stuff. And at one point, I actually saw on Flushing Avenue a chocolate factory. And I thought, bingo. There we go. Now we know why it smells like chocolate everywhere. So when I had done enough of that, read enough letters, listened to in person or read enough oral histories, it was almost like I developed a second memory bank consisting of other people's memories. And those details, the sounds, the smells would come to me as if they were my own memories.
And it was someone in one of your writing groups who suggested Manhattan Beach itself to you, and you went and scouted out and found a house that was the right house?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but when I started writing the book and it was on a beach, first of all, I was taken aback because I thought I was going to begin at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. But I was on a beach where there were fancy houses, which I knew had been the case. Manhattan Beach is just two beaches down from Coney Island, and all of that was very fancy at one point before the subway reached that far and, you know, regular people started arriving and the fancy people didn't want to be there anymore. So I was sort of hoping there were still a few fancy houses around Coney Island. I was completely wrong. There were not. But there were still some on Manhattan Beach, which was probably the fanciest of all. I mean, there were huge Gilded Age hotels there at one point. It was an area with an interesting history.
Yeah. Question over here.
Hi. I think, you know, this is, you might almost have answered it, but sight and sound have always been privileged of the five senses beyond smell and taste and definitely touch. And we've got embodied cognition. So you're talking about your imagination, your second memory of the smells, the taste, etc. But how vital is it for you to actually go and be physically in touch? You talked about the shipyard. It's almost that visceral thing. Do you have to get away from your writing, sitting in your desk, and actually go and experience first, you know, in an embodied way, the actual smell, the actual taste, and touching of it to really lift yourself into the vivacity of what you want to describe beyond your own imagination, which is sitting in your body, sitting at your desk?
I find that very much so. I really do need, there's nothing like just physically being in a place, and it's sort of related to the idea of talking to real people, which is another thing we really share. And so I guess I would almost give an example. Well, I'll say that, for example, I read a lot about the Merchant Marine in the book, and I learned a lot about ships. I mean, I read books about Liberty ships, and I had diagrams and maps. I mean, anything involving wartime is incredibly documented. There is no shortage of information about the nuts and bolts and mechanics of it. But there, what was more helpful than anything else was going to this functional Liberty ship that still exists in the San Francisco Harbor, where I just had the best time. First of all, luckily, Liberty ships were mass-produced and identical to each other, so that was very convenient for me. I was essentially on the ship I was writing about. It was as if it physically existed. But also there were these old mariners who were working as docents. A number of them had worked during the war on ships, and so it was amazing to talk to them. And, you know, it was just more of this... I mean, for me, there's just nothing like physically being somewhere and actually having conversations with people to not only be interesting in and of itself, but somehow ignite all of the other information that I've learned. You said something like that earlier, that you know, archival research is spectacular, but sometimes that's not enough for me to really create life on the page around it. And just talking to a human being or going to a physical place can give me access to all of the other learning that I have to bring it to life in ways that I couldn't otherwise.
The thing that I found really terrifying was after I did all the research and interviews and did all the paper research, I would try to figure out if there were certain scenes that I could not imagine feeling. So, for example, when my characters need to make money, initially she starts becoming a peddler. And so I started to interview peddlers, and then I realized that when I was interviewing peddlers, it's not like peddlers want to go and have lunch with you. So I had to go to where they worked and hang out with them. And then I realized that I realized just how protected my life is. Like, I can close a door to do my work. And when you're a peddler in an open market, as a woman, and you don't have language skills, either fluency in that master language or even literacy in your own, that means very often you're so physically vulnerable to the exterior world, and just standing in front of a card table or the equivalent and having to work and having anyone who has, let's say, the equivalent of 30 cents, have the right to speak to you and do commerce with you, that was terrifying. And I realized that I needed to have those feelings in order to make it fiction. Because after I knew everything, I still had to feel what she felt. And then I realized that until I felt her terror, I really couldn't write that character.
Okay. On choosing the storyline or where the plot goes, how did you guys choose it first of this is where I want to go? Or did you let history dictate where to take?
That's such a good question. I never make choices about plot because I find that the ideas I can have just imagining, okay, what could happen, are not good enough. They're the ideas anyone might have. So the reason I write in the weird way that I do is that I'm trying to come up with things that I can't think of. I am literally trying to get sort of under my thoughts or beyond them. So I will often think as I'm writing my way through the first draft, which usually is very lurching plot-wise, and I have to kind of move things around, but I'll often think, okay, what are the possibilities of what could happen here? I mean, obviously I'm thinking that as I'm writing forward, but I tend to hope that any of those possibilities I can think of will not be things that will happen. They're almost like routes that I should not take because I can think of them. So I try to find instinctively a route that avoids all of those possibilities I can see. And then ultimately I shape the whole book around those those moves, but the best moves come instinctively for me.
I can't stand historical fiction. But Pachinko and Manhattan Beach are two of my favorite books of recent years. These are two extraordinary authors. Please join me in thanking Min Jin Lee and Jennifer Egan.